Thank you very much. I'd also like to thank the organizers for the invitation. Is this working? Or okay, they can't really hear it. So this talk is going to be about unitary representations. So let me start reminding you briefly what it is. So a unitary representation of a topological group on a Hilbert space. This is just a continuous homomorphism from the group to the unitary group of the Hilbert space, or if you want an action of the group on the Hilbert space. Okay, and so representation theory is a very classical subject, and one of the reasons studying unitary representations is important is that you can produce unitary representations from many other objects. So if you have a group acting on some sort, say for example on a measure space, or in different sorts of combinatorial objects, often you can produce from this unitary representation. So if you know, if you have information about the unitary representations of a group, then you also have information about the action of the group on other objects. Okay. And classically, the theory, representation theory, usually restricts itself to locally compact groups. And actually, for a good reason, because the Haar measure on locally compact groups, it allows you. So there are two things. One, it allows you to have a convolution structure on the function algebra, and also it gives you very nice. Nice topologies to work with on functions on the group. And in general, a Haar measure is not available for non-locally compact groups. So I suppose part of this talk is to see what sort of things you can do if you don't have a Haar measure. Continue to remind you some things. So the reason that we restrict ourselves to unitary representations rather than, say, general linear representations of a group is this property that I put over there, that unitary representations are completely reducible. So if you have an invariant subspace K of your Hilbert space H, then its orthogonal complement is also invariant. So somehow your representation will split as a sum of two representations. So when you have this, it makes sense to actually restrict your study to the representations which cannot be split into two pieces. And those are called the irreducible representations. Yeah, so this is the same thing as in ergodic theory, where you restrict your attention usually to ergodic actions of a group. Okay, so just word of warning. So in general, of course, it's not true that every representation will split as a sum of irreducible representations. Well, for example, if you look at the electrical representation of the Rios, which is basically just the Fourier transform. But at least for locally compact groups, what you know is that it will always split as a direct integral. Stuff. So what one tries to do is to understand the irreducible representation of a group. Also maybe if you have some well-known interesting representations, try to understand how they're built out of irreducible. Okay. So usually, for example, the left regular representation of a locally compact group. The groups that I'm going to focus my attention on are those permutation groups that actually have been mentioned by many, many people already. So for me, a permutation group would just be a group, a topological group G that acts continuously and faithfully on a countable set X. Okay, so X could also be finite. So those are, okay, so if you denote by S of X the group of all permutations of X, we'll just consider the ones, the permutation groups which are closed, which means that they're closed in the pointwise convergence topology. When you take your set X to be discrete, so this is the same thing. You just look at the group S infinity. This is this permutation group of an infinite set, and you look at closed subgroups of it. Okay, so there is this an important property of those groups is that they have a basis at the identity that consists of open subgroups. And in fact, this property characterizes them, right? So if you have any group which has a basis at the identity consisting of open subgroups, then it can be represented as a closed permutation group. I think I said everything that is on the slide. So let me start. This is a very classical theorem about representations of locally compact groups, and basically says that there are always sufficiently many irreducible representations of locally compact groups. So that means the representations just they separate points. So if you have well, if you have any x which is not the identity, there is a representation which does not map x to the identity of the Hilbert space. Okay, so this I should mention that this theorem fails in general for non-locally compact groups. So two examples I'm aware of. So the first one is the homomorphism group of the reals. This is the theorem of Megrelishvili, that this group has no unitary representations whatsoever. I mean, apart from the trivial representation, it just maps everything to the identity. And the other example, this is an observation of Pestov. If you look at this group, which already appeared, so this is all measurable maps from a standard probability space to the torus with the topology of convergence in measure. So this one does have a representation. Of course, it acts on L2 of the measure by pointwise multiplication. But on the other hand, it does not have any irreducible representations at all. So the way to see this is that, well, because this group is extremely amenable, it actually, if it has a finite dimensional representation, then it has to act on the sphere. But if it acts on the sphere, then there is a fixed point on the sphere. But this cannot happen if the representation is irreducible, right? You cannot have fixed non-zero vectors in an irreducible representation. So that's it. Okay, so this is another example in which this theorem fails. No, a one-dimensional representation which fixes a point is trivial. Yeah, this is yes, this is, I suppose, the point. It does have the trivial representation. Okay. No, so the point is that it does have the trivial representation which is irreducible, but it has no other representation. And well, and I think it's still a valid example. Suppose the first theorem is that in fact the conclusion of this theorem that you have sufficiently many irreducible representations also holds for this class of groups, which are closed subgroups of S infinity. Okay, so at least, I mean, it makes sense to try to study to have a representation theory for those groups because of this. At least there are sufficiently many, so you can try to study them. Maybe I should make here some sort of a general comment that actually this is not the first situation in which closed subgroups of S infinity have quite similar behavior to locally compact groups. So to other similar situations that I'm aware of is the results of Glasner and Weiss on spatial realizations of Boolean actions. Okay, that Ola mentioned in the morning. That if you have a Boolean action, so if the group is locally compact or it is a closed subgroup of S infinity, then it has a spatial realization. And another example is Hjort's results on turbulence, namely that subgroups of S infinity, as well as locally compact groups, cannot have turbulent actions. This is another example. Those groups, although groups of groups of S infinity are not locally compact, in some sense there are still some parts of the well-known theory for locally compact groups that transfers to those groups. And I should probably also mention, what Ole talked about today, this new class of groups. So the, what is it, isometry groups of locally compact spaces, of which they have this characterization. This looks like a very natural class, which is generalization of both. So I mean, I would bet that, for example, this theorem would extend to this class. But it will be a lot more difficult, I should say. Because when you go to locally compact, when you go from discrete to locally compact group, representation theory becomes a lot more difficult. So Mackey, I mean, he has a series of papers from the 50s and the 60s where he develops a lot of things. But it's technically things become a lot more difficult when you have the Haar measure instead of just a discrete situation. Okay, this was just some sort of philosophical comment. We continue. This is a reminder of the classical theorem of Peter and Weil, which tells you more or less everything you'd like to know about the representations of compact groups. So if you have a compact group, then every irreducible representation of it is finite dimensional. Also, every representation of the group splits as a sum of irreducible representations. The left regular representation actually contains as direct summons all irreducible representations with certain multiplicities. So in particular, if you start with a metrizable group, then the group has no more than countably many irreducible representations. So in fact, it makes sense that if you have a group like this, to just, well, to sit down and write all the representations. I mean, you could have a theorem of the sort, okay, those are all irreducible representations for this compact group. Okay, and this would be a classification result. And in fact, this has been done in all classical situations, of course, compact Lie groups, things like this. On the other end of the spectrum, there are the non-classification results. So this is the compact, is somehow the best possible thing. But on the other end of the spectrum, you have the discrete groups, for which it's an old result of automa that if you have a discrete group which is not abelian by finite, then the equivalence relation of unitary equivalence on the irreducible representations is in fact not smooth. And Hjort improved this recently. He showed that it's in fact not quasi-shallow by countable structure. So it's some sort of a complicated equivalence relation, and there isn't really a hope of writing down in some reasonable way the all the irreducible representations of a discrete group. So somehow, representation theory has, if you want, two different branches. So one which concerns itself with classification of the representations of the groups of type 1. So type 1 are those for which you can actually write down all the irreducible representations. And the other one, which is somehow concerns itself more with discrete groups, where this is not possible, but then you try to do some sort of, you try to do what you can do without actually classifying all irreducible representations. So you prove general theorems that hold for certain classes of representations and things like this. So this talk falls more in the first part of the, okay? So it will be a classification of this. All right, those are not, there are actually some previous results on classification theorems for unitary representations of non-locally compact groups. So those are some that I'm aware of. So the first one, I know, is the result of Lieberman from 1972, which classifies all unitary representations of this group as infinity. So this is the permutations of an infinite set. There is a similar result for the unitary groups of the infinite dimensional Hilbert space. So there's an announcement of Kirillov that was published in 73. He never published the proof. On the other hand, Ulfansky later published five different proofs of this classification. And also, this is another example. This is the general linear group on an infinite dimensional vector space over a finite field. So the Lieberman's proof, it's quite ad hoc. It only applies to this group. It's somehow difficult to generalize. But on the other hand, Ulfansky developed for more than 10 years, he was working on representation. He developed some sort of a general theory. And he developed the so-called semi-group method. So all of those proofs, they use the fact that you have inside an increasing union of compact subgroups, and also this method uses the fact that actually the set of double cosets of those compact subgroups actually forms, in a nice way, a semi-group. Okay, and so I suppose what I'm doing is develop a new method which encompasses at least the first and the third result. And for continuous groups, I cannot really say much. Which does not rely on this sort of construction. So it's a new method. So I continue reminding you some things. So the uniformities on the group, those were mentioned in the previous talk. So just quickly, the left uniformity of the group is defined like this. So a function is left uniformly continuous if this thing holds. It's right uniformly continuous if the symmetric thing holds, which should be known. And so what will be important for me, so we say that the function is uniformly continuous if it is uniformly continuous both on the left and on the right. Okay, and those three notions, they define three different uniformities on the group. So those are the left uniformity, the right uniformity, and they are lowest upper bound. Okay, one of the bounds. Okay, the join of the two uniformities, which is the lower. Okay, so the lower bound, or also known as the Ryoke uniformity of the group. Once you have a uniformity, you can try to complete it, and then see what you get. So you say that the group is pre-compact if when you complete, say, the left uniformity or the right, this is equivalent, you get a compact group. Okay, so this is a weaker notion. So you say that the topological group is a Ryoke precompact if its lower uniformity is precompact. Okay, so that's if that doesn't talk too much to you, you can look at the next sentence, which is it's a very concrete thing. So this means that for every neighborhood of the identity, there exists a finite set F such that UFU covers the whole group. So if you remove one of the U's, you get the classical notion of a precompact group. Okay. This notion was introduced by Ryoke, who also found the first example. I mentioned this later, and then was extensively studied by Uspensky, and also by Glasner and Grelishvili later. This is some basic facts about those Ryoke precompact groups if you see them for the first time. So uh, okay, So first of all, if you have a real Capri-compact group and you have a uniformly continuous function, then it's automatically bounded, yeah, because it extends to a compact space. So locally compact groups, they're not interesting for this notion. A locally compact group is real Capri-compact if and only if it is compact, right? Because indeed, if you have, if you start with a compact, how does the pointer work? Okay. So if you start with a compact neighborhood of the identity, well, then U will be compact, so G, the whole group, will be compact. Also, if you look at abelian groups, or more generally, okay, this is small invariant neighborhood. So this just means it's a group that admits both-sided invariant metrics for a group on which the left and the right uniformities coincide. So for those groups, it's not the notion is not interesting either. Well, because again, if you have a real Capri-compact group which is like this, then because the two uniformities are the same, I mean, it just means that it's pretty compact. So this basically means that I'm not going to be interested in groups like this. Okay. So here are some examples. Okay, so the first one, this is the original example that was given by Rilke. So this is just the homomorphism group of the reals with the standard topology, the compact open topology. Okay, so another. I mean, I think this is a historical, well, more or less. Another example is the unitary group of an infinite dimensional Hilbert space. This is due to Uspensky. The automorphism group of a standard Lebesgue space. This is due to Glasner. And the geometry group of the Eurosum space of diameter 1. So this is also the result of Uspensky. And also oligomorphic permutation groups, which I'm going to mention later. But I should mention that, okay, so there is a uniform way that works for all of those things, and I'm getting to this. But there's a uniform proof of all of those theories. It's another thing which is probably good to know. So this is actually a very nice class of groups. So they have a lot of closure properties. So they're closed under various group theoretic operations. Basically, everything that compact groups are closed under, except taking closed subgroups. Okay, so let me read it. So they're closed under taking open subgroups, products, inverse limits, group extensions, and also homomorphisms with dense image. So the last one means that if you start with a real Capri-compact group G and the homomorphism into a group H, such that the image is dense, then H is also real Capri-compact. So you see, for a compact group, this is not so interesting, because if the image is dense, then it must be surjective. But here, there are interesting examples in which you get actually dense image. And it's not surjective, so it's actually, I mean, it makes more sense to look at this. Okay, but very importantly, it's not stable when they're taking closed subgroups. Okay, so this just doesn't work. All right, so this is a very simple application of this notion, just to show you that it's good for something. So you say that this is a definition of Rosendahl. So this property was meant as a topological extension of the previous Bergman property, which was introduced before that by Bergman, but I'm not going to get into this. So you say that a topological group has a property OB, so this stands for bounded orbits. If every time it acts on a metric space continuously, then every orbit is bounded. Okay? So this is meant as a very strong generalization of the strengthening of property SH. Let me address the classical representation theoretic property SH, which tells you that every time you act on a Hilbert space, there is a bounded orbit by isometries. And this is just for any metric space. So we just this. And then he found, he has a lot of examples in his paper. But for example, I mean, this is a very big class of examples. It's, for example, all real Capri-compact groups. Yeah, because for a very simple reason. If you fix any point x0 in your space, and then you look at this function from the group to the real numbers that sends the element of the group to the distance between x0 and its image under G. So it's easy to check that this function is both left and right uniformly continuous. So by our thing, it's bounded. So the orbit is bounded, so that's it. Okay. So here's another philosophical comment. That this property is real Capri-compactness. It's likely to be important every time you deal with a situation in which there are uniformly continuous functions. So, for example, a typical example in which you have uniformly continuous functions is when you have a unitary representation of a group. Then you can look at matrix coefficients, which are defined like this. So you fix two vectors psi and eta in your Hilbert space, And then you look at this is a function on G that maps G to the inner product of pi gxi and eta. So this function is uniformly continuous. And so you see when you can look at the C star algebra of those uniformly continuous bounded functions on the group. So the fact that if the group is Polish and it's also Ryokai precompact, then this C star algebra is actually separable in the norm topology. So in a sense, there are very few uniformly continuous bounded functions. So there is a hope that you can say something about them. Because in most situations, for example, for discrete groups, this algebra is just L infinity, which is a horrible. It's not horrible. It's a very nice algebra, but it's difficult to say things about it because it's not separable. Well, in this situation, you get a separable algebra, so it's a better situation. Okay. Well, this end the philosophical comment. All right. So now we try to put together the two notions that we had. So we had permutation groups, and then we had this Ryokai precompact groups. Okay. So this is somehow the groups that we're interested in, and so now let's explain what they are, okay, the intersection of those notions. Okay, so here is the definition. Say that a closed permutation group is oligomorphic if the action of n tuples, so you have G acting on X, then it very naturally acts on n tuples of X, right? I mean, in the diagonal, very natural way. So you say that the action is oligomorphic if it has finitely many orbits for every n. Okay, so it's a Wardenness condition on the group, right? Because you say that it has a few orbits, so this means that the group itself is Ward. If I forget to say permutation group, then you call the group, a group by itself is abstractly oligomorphic if it can be realized as an oligomorphic permutation group. Okay. All right, so now let's try to translate the definition of Ryokai precompactness for those subgroups of S infinity and see what happens. Okay, so a closed subgroup of S infinity is Ryokai precompact. So if for every neighborhood of the identity, but you see here, the neighborhoods of the identity are actually groups. So you can say that for every open subgroup, the set of, this thing UXU now becomes, double coset, right? In those things, when V is a subgroup, those things are disjoint from each other. So this just the group splits into double cosets. So this just means that, there are only finitely many of them. Yeah? So now it's kind of clear how this is a compactness condition. It's a very, this is a very, very, very simple situation. So this is why, everything works so nicely. Okay, so here is the characterization. All right, so if you start with a closed subgroup of S infinity, then the following things are equivalent. So G is Ryokai precompact. This is one of the notions. Also, if you have any continuous transitive action on a countable set, then the action is oligomorphic. Okay, then you get finitely many orbits on every n for every n. And then, of course, you have to start with a transitive action, because if you start with an action that has infinitely many orbits, this is not going to work. And the final thing is G is just an inverse limit of oligomorphic groups. Okay, and those three things are actually equivalent. It's probably about time I gave you some examples. Everything up to here was kind of abstract. Permutation groups, they arise naturally in model theory as automorphism groups of countable structures. So how do you get a permutation group? Well, you have your set X, you put some structure on the set, and then you look at the group that preserves all of this structure. Okay, and this will be a closed subgroup. Naturally, and this is, in fact, of course, every subgroup can be gotten in this way. And of all of those groups, oligomorphic groups play a central role in model theory, at least a model theory of countable structures, because of this theorem here of, Engel, Wilner-Devsky, and Svenonius. I think they proved different parts of it, and it was combined. I think no one ever stated. They didn't state it like this, but this is the essence of the theorem that. If you have with a countable structure X, then the following two things are equivalent. So the permutation group, this looked as a permutation group, is oligomorphic, and the structure is omega categorical. So omega categorical, this just means that X is the unique countable model of the first order theory of the structure. If you want, so that the theory and the structure are the same thing. There is a unique canonical model for the theory. So in fact, so what happens is that in this situation, there is correspondence between types on the structure and orbits of the group. So there is really a very nice correspondence between the model theory and the and the permutation group theory. So this is the natural setting to look at those things, or exactly the oligomorphic groups. Okay. All right, so let's pass the examples. All right, so the homogeneous structures, or the ultra-homogeneous structures, it's the same thing. They appeared already many times. Okay, so just a reminder, so you say that the structure is homogeneous if every isomorphism between finite substructures instead to a full automorphism of the structure. There is homogeneity in the strongest possible sense. Okay, so what's important here is this, that if you have any homogeneous structure in a relational language with only finitely many symbols in each arity, so you say for every n, you have only finitely many symbols of with n places, then the group is in fact, then thing is oligomorphic. Okay, so this covers a lot of examples. So this covers all of the examples that were considered so far, apart from the Urysohn space, because it has, for the Urysohn space, you see, you need a relation symbol for every distance. So this gives you infinitely many relation symbols of arity two, so this is not oligomorphic, okay, this does not work. But it covers all the other examples. Okay, so this is Frechette's construction, which is, okay, it's a way of producing of a class of finite structures to produce a homogeneous infinite structure. Okay, so a class with that satisfies a certain amalgamation property. Okay, so here, some examples which I just wrote. So again, if you start with finite sets, you just get the countably infinite set. The group is S infinity. If you start with finite linear orders, you get the countable dense linear ordering without endpoints, and the group is the automorphism group of this thing. If you start with finite graphs, you get the random graph. If you start with finite vector spaces over a finite field, you get, not surprisingly, the countable dimensional vector space over the same field. If you start with finite Boolean algebras, you get the countable atomless Boolean algebra, which is the same thing as the algebra of Kwolpen sets of the Cantor space. So the group is the automorphism group of this algebra, which is the same thing, the homomorphism group of the Cantor space. Okay, so those are just some examples. There are thousands of examples which have been studied a lot. All right. Okay, so now we need just a small bit of group theory, okay, in order to continue. So if you have G, so this is completely abstract. So if you have two subgroups H1 and H2 of group G, you say that they're commensurate if their intersection has finite index in both. Okay, and then the commensurator of a group H in G is just, this is the set of all elements in G such that H and its conjugate by G, so this HG stands for GHG inverse, they're commensurate. Okay, so this is something like a normalizer, but when you allow for a finite error, right? I mean, this would be the normalizer if you say that H and HG are equal, but now you say that, okay, maybe they're not exactly equal, but they're very close to each other. There's only a finite error. Okay, so this is a subgroup of G. All right, so this one is a general thing, but if G is oligomorphic, then things are particularly nice. So if G is an open subgroup, then it always has finite index in its commensurator. And also this operation is idempotent. So when you apply it twice, it's the same thing as just applying it once. And a way to, say that the group is commensurator if it is open and it's equal to its own commensurator, right? Or this is equivalent to it being the commensurator of something. It's the same thing by the second thing over there. Okay, so this is an one way to think of this is that, so commensurators are exactly the open subgroups of your group which have no supergroups of finite index. Okay, but this is a very special thing for oligomorphic groups. So for general groups, this is very false. Okay, all of those things. But here things are very nice, as I said. Okay, all right. Okay, so this is the final preparatory slide. I mean, just a quick reminder what an induced representation is. All right, so if you have a group G, induction, this is a method to produce representations. So if you start from a subgroup H and you have a representation of H, to produce a representation of G. So this is the particularly simple case in which H is open in G, where everything is very nice, you don't need measures, you don't need anything. So the induced representation is defined in the following way. So you look at the space of all functions f from G to the Hilbert space of your representation sigma, this is the representation of H, which are equivariant, according to this formula here. I mean, the things on the left, on the right, and with inverses are put in such a way that it works. Okay. All right, so those are the functions which are equivalent in this way. And then you can define a norm on those functions. So you just look at the value of a function like this is determined by its values on this system of coset representatives, right? Because when you multiply by h, you know what happens. This is defined by this equality. So it only, I mean, you can just look at the, to define the norm, you just look, I mean, basically this is a function on coset, okay? So this is the natural way to define the norm. And then your Hilbert space is just all those functions with finite norm, or which is the same thing. This is all L2 functions from the coset space G over H to the Hilbert space of the original representation. So it's actually possible to start with this space and then just define the representation directly on it. But then you have to use some sort of a cocycle. So actually this is more convenient because here the representation, the way it acts on a function, is just by left multiplication. Okay, so I mean, this is a very classical thing. All right, so now let's try to look at what sort of representations those permutation groups have, or subgroups of S infinity. So if you have a subgroup of S infinity, well, okay, it does not have the regular representation, right? Because we don't have a Haar measure, so there's no regular representation. But on the other hand, we have a lot of quasi-regular representations. So this is just, if you take an open subgroup V and you look at the coset space G over V, then of course you have an action on L2 of this thing just by permuting the basis. Okay. So now let's try to look a bit more carefully at this representation. Okay. So suppose you have a situation like this. So you have V is open, and then V is normal in N, and then, well, N is some subgroup of G. Okay, then what happens? So you start with this representation, L2 of this. And this is the same thing as if you induce from V to G, you just induce the trivial representation from V to G. Okay? This is the same thing. Then, by this formula of iterative induction, it's the same thing to induce from V to G. It's the same thing as first inducing from V to N, and then inducing from N to G. Okay? But when you induce from V to N, because V is normal in N, this is the same thing as just the left regular representation of the quotient N by V. Just you look at this as a representation of N, right? So this is just the left regular representation of this finite group here. Oh, did I mention this? So every time you have V normal in N, this has to have a finite index, because by what I said, right, you have only finitely many double cosets. But of course, if the group is normal, then double cosets are the same thing as single cosets. So just the group is of finite index. Okay. So this the index here is finite. So this is a left regular representation of a finite group, which splits, of course, as a direct sum of the irreducible representations of these finite groups. Okay. So basically, by looking at this very simple thing, we are led to consider actually representations of this type. Right. So just an induced representation from some group, from some finite factor of it, and then irreducible representation of the finite group, and then you induce. Okay. So those are the representations that we consider. Okay. So now let's look at those, and we have to decide, for example, whether they're irreducible or whether they're the same. So there is this is a classical result called the Mackey irreducibility criterion, which was done by Mackey for special cases of one-dimensional representations, and then was extended by Korulin and actually many other authors for finite-dimensional representations. So this is a special case that works here and is actually simpler than the general theory, which says the following. So if you start with an oligomorphic group, then the following things hold. So if H is a commensurator, V is normal in H, and sigma is a representation of this finite group, then you actually, if you start with an irreducible representation sigma, then you get, when you induce, you still get an irreducible representation. Okay. So this very essentially uses the fact that H is a commensurator, otherwise this is false. In fact, if H is not a commensurator, this is false. Okay, it's not irreducible. Okay, so and this is for irreducibility and for equivalence. So if you have two different commensurators, H1 and H2, and two subgroups, V1 and V2, in this way, and you two representations, sigma 1 and sigma 2, then the results are the same when you induce, if and only if they're conjugate. So H2 is conjugate to H1, and the two representations are conjugate. Okay. So this list is as nice as it can be without repetitions, and everything is irreducible if you only look at commensurators. Okay, so I suppose this is the main theorem, that in fact those are all representations of oligomorphic groups. Okay, so you start with an oligomorphic group. Okay, so this also works for a real pre-compact subgroup of S infinity, right? An inverse limit of things like this. then every unitary representation of G is a sum of irreducible representations of this form. So you start with an H, which is a commensurator, you look at the finite index normal subgroup, you look at the quotients, you look at the irreducible representation, and then you induce. All right. So this is this. I mean, basically, those representations that I explained on the previous slides are just all the irreducible representations, and every representation splits as a sum of irreducibles. Okay. So it's a fact, I believe this is due to Cameron, but it's actually quite easy, that every oligomorphic group has only countably many different open subgroups. So in particular, those representations, there are only countably many of them. Okay? And the group is of type 1, because every representation splits as a sum of irreducibles, so this is... so it's a nice group for which you can just list all the representations in this way. Okay, now, so let's do something more concrete. Okay, this was kind of the abstract theory. So now let's look at concrete examples and see what we can do. So from the theorem, to write down the representations, it's important to know what the open subgroups are, in particular the commensurators. Once we know this, then we know everything. So this is a particularly simple situation in which it's just very easy to do everything. So this is why I chose this. So a reminder, if you start with the Frese limit, it has the strong amalgamation property if the stabilizer of any finite substructure has infinite orbits outside of the substructure itself. Okay, so this is the same thing as, I mean, if you're familiar with the amalgamation property, this is the same thing that you can amalgamate in the most independent possible way. So the intersection is only the bottom structure. So there is this theorem of Cameron, which says that, okay, so suppose you have a structure which has this strong amalgamation property, and also this satisfies this additional condition, okay, that stabilizers of finite substructures, they act primitively on their orbits. Okay, primitively means that there are no invariant equivalence relations. Okay, I mean, if you see this for the first time, maybe it's not completely clear what it means, but, I mean, it doesn't matter too much. I'm going to give examples. I'm just going to apply the theorem. Then the conclusion of the theorem is that basically, the only open subgroups are the ones that you see immediately. So what are those? I mean, you have, of course, if you have a finite substructure, you have the pointwise stabilizer of the structure, which is an open subgroup. You also have the setwise stabilizer of the structure, right? This which just stabilizes the substructure as a set, but maybe not the point. And then, of course, you have everything in between, which is, I mean, so the small one has finite index in the big one, and then maybe you have some groups in between, but those are all the open subgroups that there are. That's it. Okay, so this is a very simple thing. So when we apply, when we combine this theorem with the previous one, so what we get is that if you start with X which satisfies all the conditions, so it's omega categorical, and it's also like this, strong amalgamation property in every stabilizer acts primitively, then in fact all the representations are of this form. So the commensurators then are just those. I mean, then those groups, when A runs over the finite substructures, the commensurators are just those groups. All of your representations you induce from the setwise stabilizer, and then you can just look at representations of those finite groups. And this finite group, the setwise stabilizer divided by the pointwise stabilizer, this is nothing but the automorphism group of the finite structure A. Right? Because if you have any automorphism of A, by the extension property of the Frese element, it just extends to a full thing. So those groups here are actually the same. Okay, so it's somehow a satisfactory description that all the representations of this of the automorphism groups of the big structure, they come from representations of the automorphism groups of the finite structures that live inside. Okay, so it's kind of a nice thing. Okay, so some examples that satisfy this property. Okay, so all the examples that I mentioned before. Okay, so the countable set without structure, so this is at infinity. The dense linear ordering, so this is the automorphism group of Q. The vector space, the Boolean algebra, so this is the homomorphism group of the N. And the random graph. And I mean, many examples. So this recovers the other results that I mentioned in the beginning of Lieberman and Olshansky. So Lieberman was for the S infinity, and Olshansky was for the vector space, where it is here. Okay. So those are for this description of the... Okay, so this is somehow maybe the nicest situation. It's the automorphism group of Q. So then, of course, here the setwise stabilizers, because finite substructures are rigid, So the setwise stabilizers and pointwise stabilizers are actually the same. Okay. So when you, I mean, when you apply the previous theorem, you just get that all the possible representations are just those. So L2 on n element subsets of Q. Okay, that's it. It acts on this thing, so this gives you a Hilbert space, and then those are all irreducible representations. Okay, so now we can go back, for example, to this group, the Homomorphism group of the Rios. And now you remember that here you can also embed the density for those groups. Yeah? So the automorphism group of Q embeds as a dense subgroup here. And then there, so all representations of this are just direct sums of things like this. So it's very easy to check that those do not extend to representations of the homomorphism group of the Rios. Okay, I mean, it's trivial. You just back something down. And then, so we recover this result of Megrelli-Sulis that I mentioned before, that this group has no representations, has no non-trivial unitary representations. Except that his result is actually more general. So what he proved is that the group has no representations by isometries on reflexive Banach spaces, which, okay, so I mean, he only works with unitary representations, so I cannot get this. But it's possible that something like this extends. Okay, so in the remaining few minutes, I think I'll say a few words about property T. Okay, so property T is it's a classical representation theory property that was introduced by Kasdan in the 60s, I believe. It has mostly been worked towards locally compact groups and particularly discrete groups, where it is certainly most useful. But it makes sense for bigger groups, and it's possible it has some applications. It's not completely clear. All right, so let me remind you the definition. So if you have a group G and some subset Q of G, and then some epsilon, and the representation pi. All right. So you say that, and you have some vector in the space of the representation. You say that it is Q epsilon almost invariant if for every x in Q, in fact, I mean Q does not move this vector too much. Okay. So this is this, and then you say that the group has a property T if there exists a compact set Q and some positive epsilon, such that every representation of G that has a Q epsilon invariant vector actually has a fixed point. Okay, actually does have a real invariant vector. So it's a rigidity property, right? If you once you have something that is almost true, then it actually there is a fixed point. All right, and you also say that the group has a strong property T if instead of compact here, you can take Q to be finite. Okay, so it's a strengthening of the property. All right. I should mention here some history. So using the representation of the theorem about unitary representations of the unitary group, the classification by Kirillov and Dulshansky, Becker showed that the unitary group of the Hilbert space has a property T. And in fact, he exhibited the two-element Kasdan set and the appropriate Kasdan constant. And in fact, of course, I mean, once you know the representations of a group, once you have a list of them, it's not that difficult. Okay, at least it becomes a combinatorial problem. I'll get to this. Okay, so a similar method, I mean, basically the same construction, allows to verify property T for those groups. Okay. In fact, every concrete group that I tried, I managed to do. But of course, it's not okay. I have a question. All right. So I mean, all of those groups that I said that so they have property T, all of them have a Kasdan set with two elements and whatever optimal Kasdan constant. So it's the same thing as Becker's result for the unitary group of the Hilbert space. Okay, so now I can give you a slightly more interesting example of an oligomorphic group. Okay, so this is an example that is not looked at too often, but I think it's actually quite interesting. So the example was first constructed by Cherlin as a counterexample of a conjecture of Laughlin in the 70s. So, okay, let me tell you what it is. So it starts with infinitely many relation symbols. En is a relation symbol on 2n letters. And it's meant to be interpreted as an equivalence relation on n element subsets of your structure. Okay, so this means so it's subsets; it's not tuples. So if you permute the things in the two parts, it's still the same, right? It's n element subsets. Okay, so and also each en has two equivalence classes. Okay, so you look at the class of finite structures where each en is an equivalence relation like this, and it has at most two classes. And then you take the Frisell limit of this. Okay, this has amalgamation, this is easy to check. You take the Frisell limit, and then you obtain the limit. All right, where the so of course in the limit every equivalence relation you have exactly two classes. All right, then the automorphism group is oligomorphic because here you see there is for each everity there is only one thing, so that's fine. All right, then what's important about this group is that it actually surjects on this compact group, just an infinite product of cyclic groups of order 2. Yeah, the reason for this is that you can just, I mean, there is, it just acts on two element sets. I mean, it acts on the equivalence classes for each equivalence relation. And those commute because they're somehow placed in the most general possible situation, so it basically surjects on this group. Okay? So in particular, Khrushchevsky noticed that this group gives a counterexample to the, what is it, the small index property. Yeah, because if you have a bad group here, if you have a bad non-open subgroup of index 2 here, and then you pull it back, you get a bad subgroup of index 2 in the big one. Anyway, this is a side remark. So Becker has shown that if you have a compact group, then if it is amenable as a discrete group, for example, if it is abelian, like here, then it does not have the strong property T. Okay, so there is no finite set that gives you property T. You need to use actually the whole compact thing. All right. And also, of course, you can conclude that G itself does not have a strong property T, because if G had a finite set, well, it would project onto this group. Okay. So in particular, you cannot always take your Kavna set, assuming that it exists, you cannot always take it to be finite. All right. So sometimes you have to look at compact. I don't know whether this can always be done. I mean, okay, I know certain things, but okay. Here is my question. So I have asked this question before in like various in different versions in the different talks that I've given on this. I think this is the best one. All right. So here is the question. So you start with the automorphism group of a relational omega categorical phrase element, which also has the strong amalgamation property. Okay. Then the question is this action G on this X always non-amenable? Okay, this is. So, is it possible to have an invariant mean on X? Correct, which is, this is the same. Then there exists a finite set Q and an epsilon, such that for every finite F, it's not almost invariant, right? So there is a G in Q which moves it at least epsilon from itself. Correct? This is equivalent to this amenability of the axiom in the standard sense. So what I know is that actually you can find an invariant mean on L infinity of X. Yeah, this is the Fauner condition and then the... Okay, so in particular what I know is that you can find, you can always find with those hypotheses, you can find Q compact. But I don't know whether you can always find finite. And this has connection with property T, I mean, for obvious reasons. I think, I mean, I don't really have the time to get there, but you see, okay, for example, I mean, if you cannot say if for every compact set there is something here which is almost invariant, then the group obviously does not have property T just because of the obvious representation on L2 of X. Okay, so there are some connections. I mean, there isn't exact correspondence because there are sometimes, I mean, there are some other representations that may not necessarily come from this action because of, say, a situation like this. So it is slightly more complicated. But this is somehow, I mean, this is a combinatorial question here, which I think is interesting. Okay, what else? Oh, actually, I have a minute. All right. So let me say one last thing. So in fact, that we assume throughout that our representations were continuous. But in fact, in many cases, we do not need to do so, because there are all of those automatic continuity results due to various people that I have listed here, that in fact, all the examples that I mentioned have this automatic continuity property, that every homomorphism from those groups to a separable group is actually continuous. So if you assume from the beginning that your Hilbert space is separable, like here, then in fact, in the theorem, you can start with arbitrary representation in a separable Hilbert space, and then it satisfies the conclusion. Of course, this condition is necessary that the Hilbert space be separable, because otherwise, I mean, if you look at this as a discrete group, it has the left regular representation, okay, which is not of this type at all, okay, of the one that I explained. All right, I think that's all. Thank you very much.